last time. We wrote Maxwell's equations were d mu f mu nu minus mu naught j nu. And then we had this other one, which is d alpha f beta gamma plus d beta f gamma alpha d gamma f alpha beta equals 0. Okay, and actually, while we're here, let me just clarify this. What I said is that this is equivalent to the statement that alpha, beta, comma, gamma, let me write it this way, d alpha, f beta, gamma, anti-symmetrized, is 0, right? And to see that, you see, when you anti-symmetrize, you're supposed to add all the permutations with signs according to whether they're even and odd. Okay? So let's just do that. It's 1/6 because there are 6 permutations. And let's start by doing the cycles. Okay? A cycle is a permutation. And a cycle of 3 objects, you move the last 2 to the front and the first 1 to the back. It's obviously an even permutation if you've got 3 objects. Right? If you've got 4 objects, a cycle is an odd permutation, right? 4 objects, you would put the last 3 indices forward and the first 1 to the back. Now, there'd be 3 crossings, so it would, and so on. But for 3 objects, a cycle is an even permutation. So let's put those down first. The alpha, well, basically, they're these quantities that I wrote above. Beta gamma plus d beta f alpha f gamma alpha plus d gamma f alpha beta. Those are the cycles. Okay, and now I need the odd permutations, and I can get those just by flipping 2 indices. So let's flip these 2 indices. And so this is minus d alpha f gamma beta minus d beta f alpha gamma minus d gamma f beta alpha, right? So now I've got all 6 permutations, and I've arranged them so the even ones are here and the odd ones are there. Okay, but we know f is antisymmetric, right? By definition, f alpha beta is minus f beta alpha. And so actually this equals that, and this equals that, and this equals that. So this is just 1/3 times the cycles. Okay? So this equation is completely equivalent to this quantity being 0. And both of them have indices. And that's going to be very important, have sort of are written in this notation of Greek indices, where some indices are summed and some are not. And that's enough to show they are invariant under a certain symmetry. So I mentioned the symmetry before, and now we're going to see it. The symmetry of, in fact, we're let me call it Lorentz symmetry. So Lorentz discovered the symmetry of Maxwell's equations just as a mathematical property. Okay, and later on, it was Einstein who realized it's not just a mathematical property. This is a fundamental feature of our world and our experience of the world. The symmetry tells us something very profound about space and time. So Lorentz symmetry is the following. Let's change space-time coordinates, okay, from x mu, which is equal to ct comma x, right, to x mu prime. And this is ct prime comma x prime, so some new set of coordinates. And the new set of coordinates is just defined to be a matrix, lambda mu nu, and you see how I'm arranging the indices with one up and one down, multiplied by the old coordinates. So it's just a linear transformation, a matrix operation on the old coordinates. And Lorentz discovered that that kind of transformation is a symmetry of these equations. In other words, if you changed coordinates, the equations would look the same. And similarly, everything with an index receives a matrix lambda. I've only defined the lambdas for upstairs indices. Let me do this. J prime nu is lambda mu nu J nu F mu nu. You see F has two indices, so it needs two lambda matrices. Nu beta, F alpha beta, etc. Now, this equation here, x prime mu equals lambda mu nu x nu, implies if lambda is invertible, then this equation implies that x nu is equal to lambda twiddle nu mu x mu prime. Okay, so in other words, I can go from primed quantities to unprimed quantities with the lambda twiddle matrix, which is the inverse of lambda. Okay, where lambda alpha beta lambda beta delta equals delta alpha delta. So that just tells you in matrices that lambda times lambda twiddle equals 1. So lambda twiddle is the inverse. Okay, lambda twiddle equals 1. And because if a matrix is the right inverse of another matrix, then it's also the left inverse of the same matrix. You can prove that. I'll leave that as an exercise for you to prove if it's not obvious. So something which is the right inverse of a matrix is also the left inverse. So lambda twiddle beta delta times lambda delta gamma is equal to delta beta gamma. Okay, so lambda twiddle is just the inverse of lambda. So providing you make the assumption that these transformations is invertible, you very naturally have lambdas and you have lambda twiddles in the game. Okay, so now the advantage of lambda twiddle is that, of course, we will need things like d by dx mu. And d by dx mu prime is equal to, by the chain rule, dx prime mu d by dx alpha. Okay, so if I'm going to differentiate with respect to x prime, what I do is first differentiate with respect to x and then work out the derivative of x with respect to x prime. But now that I've got this lambda twiddle matrix, this is lambda twiddle alpha mu d by dx alpha. Okay, and by the way, sometimes I'm often writing d by dx alpha equals d alpha. And in fact, often I'll use the notation that d by dx alpha of some quantity equals d alpha of the quantity equals phi comma alpha, just to save a little bit more space. Okay, so now we know how derivatives transform. And you see the derivative has a downstairs index. And so what this tells us is that downstairs indices transform with lambda twiddle, with the inverse of lambda. Upstairs indices transform with lambda. And that's everything. As long as you've written your equations in this manner with upstairs and downstairs indices, then the whole equation is going to transform homogeneously, meaning every term in it will transform in exactly the same way. And if you have some contracted indices, these are called contracted indices, one is up and one is down, the up is going to go with lambda, and the down is going to go with lambda twiddle, and the lambda-lambda twiddle will cancel. So contracted indices don't transform at all. Okay? So So we need another property, which is that we recall F alpha beta is equal to eta alpha delta eta beta gamma F delta gamma. That's how we raised the indices with this funny eta. And we want F alpha beta prime to be equal to lambda alpha gamma lambda beta delta F gamma delta, right? Because then everything's going to work. If the upstairs index on F transforms with lambdas, then basically when I transform this equation, when I prime everything, I'm just going to get a lambda times that index on this side and a lambda times this index on that side, and it's the same equation, just multiplied by lambda, which is invertible, and so I can just remove it. So, but in order for this to happen, we have to decide, how does eta transform? And this requires, so basically, you require that eta prime has to be eta. Okay, i.e., lambda alpha beta lambda gamma delta eta beta delta equals eta alpha gamma. So eta must be an invariant under the Lorentz transformation. And it turns out that that's the definition of Lorentz transformations. This is the definition of Lorentz transformations which is that eta with either upstairs or downstairs indices is invariant. So eta alpha beta equals lambda equals eta gamma delta lambda gamma alpha lambda delta beta. So that equation is just saying eta with downstairs indices is invariant. And then you can check that this implies and is implied by eta alpha beta equals lambda alpha gamma lambda beta delta eta gamma delta. Okay, so this is the fundamental definition of a Lorentz transformation. And if you're familiar with rotations in three dimensions, right, in 3D rotations are defined as follows, that x prime I is, x prime I is Oij xj. So rotation is just a linear transformation on the coordinates, such that O transpose O equals 1, right? And this equation guarantees that the length of any vector, x prime squared equals x squared. Okay, so if I take some vector and I rotate it, it doesn't change its length. And that's guaranteed by this equation, because obviously x transpose prime x prime is equal to O x transpose O x, which is, because this is 1, is x transpose x. And so Lorentz transformations are absolutely analogous to these transformations, which are orthogonal. These are called orthogonal transformations. Okay. The only difference is this funny matrix eta, which has a minus 1 in it. But as I've indicated, that's really very, very fundamental. Yeah?
Why does the boxed equation not have lambda twiddles?
You could put, you see, lambda twiddle transforms, oh, yeah, that's a good point. As I said, lambda twiddle transforms downstairs, lambda transforms upstairs indices, lambda twiddle, yeah, you're right, should be lambda twiddle.
Either of them would work.
Pardon?
Either of them would work.
Well, you could say I define a matrix lambda to be the guy that transforms downstairs indices, and then lambda twiddle to be the upstairs indices. It really doesn't make any difference. Okay, as long as you bear in mind that lambda is always the inverse of lambda twiddle, and vice versa. Okay. So, but yeah, you're right.
Okay, so a similar question is, analogous to orthogonal matrices, is there a convenient definition for lambda twiddle in terms of lambda that would be useful? Instead of just swapping,
The definition of lambda twiddle is just that it's the inverse. Delta beta equals delta alpha beta. That's the definition of lambda twiddle.
The box equation would be the same without the twiddle. You can just post multiply by lambda.
It
works,
yes.
Yeah. Yes, I guess you're right. It works the same way.
Yeah.
I could work at this, yeah, you're right. I can always multiply by lambdas on the right, right? And so I'd get eta alpha beta lambda alpha gamma lambda, you're right. Beta delta is equal to eta gamma delta. Right, because I just multiply by 2 lambdas both sides, and then these guys cancel, and so that's still true. Okay, so we can use this as the definition of lambda. Good. Any other questions? Okay, so let's see some examples of of lambda. And one way I can write this equation, or this equation, is, you see, as a matrix equation, well, in fact, let me make it look analogous to this one. As a matrix equation, you see this index alpha is contracted with the first index. So if you regard this as the row and the column, you've got the row contracted with the row. Okay? So let's try and write it as a matrix. And what it looks like as a matrix is this equation equals eta. Okay, where you see if I transpose a matrix, I just exchange the rows and columns. And that means that I contract the rows with the rows. Okay? And so this equation can be written as a matrix like that. And that's the difference with this orthogonal transformation, is just to insert an eta in between the two matrices. So in particular, if I want to think of some examples of this matrix, let's start with an orthogonal transformation. Okay, let's just pick lambda to be, okay, so this is the row, and this is the column. And let's pick lambda to be 1 in the time direction, so that we don't see that minus sign sort of has no consequence. And let's put an ordinary rotation in the xy direction. Okay, so now this is a rotation matrix, which you can see as follows. O, let's define O to be this 2 by 2 matrix, minus sine theta cos theta. Okay, and you can check that O transpose O is equal to 1. And geometrically, what's going on is that x prime y prime is equal to O times xy. And this gives you that x prime is x cos theta plus y sine theta, and y prime is minus x sine theta plus y cos theta. And if you think about that, that is just the following rotation, x and y. Now, if I rotate the axes, x prime and y prime, and I've got some point, and I've got some point up here, if I know the old coordinates, x and y, okay, then the new coordinates, well, the x prime is given by dropping a perpendicular to the x prime axis, and the y prime coordinate is of course given by this. Okay, and so with a little bit of geometry, this angle is theta. This, I've done it the other way around, have I? Ah, right. Drop that vertical. Whoops. This distance is x. This distance is x cos theta. This distance is y sine theta, because that angle is also theta. And you end up with exactly those equations. So basically, when you rotate axes, you end up with a transformation, with an orthogonal transformation. This is a right angle. And that's the simplest example of a Lorentz transformation. Just rotate axes in space. Not surprising, that leaves Maxwell's equations invariant. So much more interesting are the Lorentz transformations, which involve space and time. Okay. More interesting transform space into time. And you can check that a matrix which satisfies this definition is, instead of cosine, it's cosh, and instead of sine, it's sinh. Okay, so i.e. X prime is equal to cosh theta X plus, let me write it the other way. CT prime is equal to CT cosh theta plus X sinh theta, and X prime is equal to X cosh theta plus, in fact, there's no minus sign here, plus CT sine theta. You can have, actually, the way I've written it is with two minus signs. Let me put two minus signs in here, just to make things a little bit more intuitive in a moment. Okay, so what kind of a transformation is this? It's a linear transformation on the axes, on the coordinates, okay? But if I draw it, it's not a rotation. Instead, it looks like this. So here's X and CT, the original coordinates. Now, let's ask, where is the X prime axis, okay, in the new coordinate? Well, the x prime axis is the locus of where t prime is 0, right? Just like the x axis is the locus where t is 0, the x prime axis is where t prime is 0. So ct prime is 0 when this equals that. Okay, so the x prime axis is where ct is equal to, so x prime axis is where ct is equal to x tan theta. Okay, so that's telling you it's a straight line with slope less than 1, because tanh is less than 1. Okay, so here's the x prime axis. Likewise, the ct prime axis, well, that's the locus of where x prime equals 0. And so that's saying that ct prime, or ct, is equal to x cot h theta. Now, that's a line whose slope is bigger than 1, right? And so I have to draw some other line. And in fact, the slopes are the inverse of each other. Okay, so if I draw a line whose slope is 1, this is ct equals x, then the ct prime and x prime axes are arranged around it symmetrically. Okay, so in fact, what a Lorentz transformation does, this type of transformation, this is called a boost, okay, for reasons that will become clear, But what a boost does is it takes the perpendicular axes and just squishes them towards the 45 degree line. Okay, and so what this means is that the lines of constant time in the new coordinates, lines of constant CT prime, well, they are lines parallel to the X prime axis. Okay, just like lines of constant time were in the original coordinates would be parallel to the X axis. Okay, it's the same with these coordinates, so you have to draw lines like this. Oops, can't draw them parallel. Okay, so these lines are constant CT prime. And lines of constant X prime are parallel to the CT prime axis. So they would go like this. Okay, so these have constant X prime. So anything that happens in space-time, I can describe either in the original coordinates, X and CT, or in the new ones. New ones are just as good as the old ones, just the axes aren't at 90 degrees. Now that doesn't really matter. Okay, they're still a perfectly good set of coordinates. And so let's try and interpret them a little more. What do the new coordinates mean? So the physical meaning of the new coordinates CT prime axis is the locus of an observer who uses CT prime and X prime as coordinates. Okay, so if you imagine somebody who tells you that somebody who defined coordinates relative to them, right, they will be traveling up that CT prime axis and using X prime as their measurements of space. And so, as we've seen, that means the locus of this observer in the original coordinates this observer is located at x equals, from the second equation, tan theta times ct. And so what it's saying is that this tan theta times c, the speed of light, is the velocity of the observer who uses the x prime t prime coordinates. And that was Einstein's big insight, is that this mathematical transformation really is telling you something about different points of view. That the observer who is stationary in the original coordinates will move up that CT axis or up any line parallel to that CT axis, and they will describe physics using the coordinates x and ct. But somebody who's moving relative to that coordinate, relative to that set of observers, will instead use the coordinates ct prime and x prime. And the relationship between them is given by theta, this sort of rotation, the relationship between the velocity and theta is this one, the tan theta. Tan theta is equal to v over c. And theta is often called the rapidity. Theta goes between minus infinity and infinity, and it's called the rapidity. And now, if you know the rapidity, of course, you know the relationship between tan theta and the other hyperbolic functions. And so cosh theta, which is 1 over sec theta, and sec theta is, sec squared theta is 1 plus tan squared, 1 minus tan squared theta. So this is square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. And sin theta is equal to cosh theta times tan theta. So that's just v over c over root 1 minus v over c squared. And so using that, you can get the Lorentz transformation in terms of more physical quantities, gamma CT minus V X over C, and X prime equals gamma X minus V over minus VT. And usually we just divide by the C here. So that would be Vx over C squared. And those are the usual formulae for the Lorentz transformation. And of course, what I can also write is because that matrix just has ones in the y and z components, y prime equals y and z prime equals z. So a Lorentz transformation involving a velocity in the x direction doesn't transform y and z at all. Okay, so now you actually know these matrices. You can work out the Lorentz transformation of electric fields, magnetic fields, currents, vector potentials, you name it. Okay, that's all there is to it. There's another sort of very important physical interpretation of Lorentz transformation, which is that notice that eta mu nu x prime nu is equal to eta mu x nu. Okay, this corresponds to x squared equals x prime squared equals x squared for rotations. So when you rotate something, its length doesn't change. When you do a Lorentz transformation, this quantity, this is called the proper distance. Let's say if I have two points, let's have one of them at x mu equals 0, and another one at some coordinate, then this quantity would be the space-time distance squared. Okay, so the distance in space-time squared. Is Lorentz invariant. The distance in space-time between any two points is Lorentz invariant. And in particular, consider a spherical shell of light. Okay, so that means that you have a lamp, let's say, that emits a spherical shell traveling outward with the speed of light, the locus of that shell is just x squared minus c squared t squared equals 0. Okay, that's according to the original observer. But any observer will see the same thing. Because x prime squared minus c squared t squared equals 0. So by any observer, I mean any observer moving at a constant velocity, for example, with respect to the original observer. And they're just going to see exactly the same equation describing the light shell. And of course, that's as it should be. The fundamental principle of relativity is that Maxwell's equations are invariant. Maxwell's equations predict the speed of light. Everybody has to agree on the speed of light. And therefore, when you see something happening involving light, you must see exactly the same thing. And in fact, more generally, there are a lot of things that people will all agree on. And one of those things is, what is the future and what is the past? So, more generally, if we draw a picture of space-time, okay, so I'm trying to represent three space and one time. I can't really draw three space, so let me only draw two space dimensions, and but time as well. So let's say this is time, or CT. And this is x, and this is, for example, y. More generally, if you have some surface here, which is ct squared minus x squared equals some number, some positive number, then everyone will agree on that. On that surface, so any observer will see exactly the surface in exactly the same locus in their coordinates, and likewise, any hyperbolic surface outside this would be c squared t squared minus x squared equals some negative number. Squared t squared minus x squared equals a positive number. This is equal to a negative number. And this is really a surface of revolution. So it really looks like that. And likewise up here. And this is a hyperboloid, which is a, so this is really a 3D hyperboloid. And everything in this past cone, so everything in this past cone is our past, or more probably is the past of whoever is sitting there. And everything up here is the future. So anything that sits, any point that sits in the future, if you do a Lorentz transformation, it'll just move around on the surface. Okay, but it will never leave the cone. And this is called the light cone. Point of, let's say, observer O. Light cone. And so Lorentz transformations preserve the causal structure of space-time. they preserve the distinction between the future times and past times. Okay, so now let's do some more concrete calculations. Some of you have probably done this before. But let's study the consequences for clocks and rulers. And basically, there are three ways to understand relativity. One is algebra, which we've used. Another one is geometry, which we've also used a little bit. And geometry has some advantages in that it's more intuitive. I mean, algebra is always correct, but doesn't give you much insight, as long as you did it correctly. Okay, algebra is right, and it's, in fact, in many ways more fundamental than geometry. Quantum mechanics is based on algebra, not so much geometry. And algebra is extremely reliable. Geometry is more intuitive. You can actually picture what's happening. And then the third way to see it is actually to imagine a physical experiment. And they should all agree, of course. And all three are useful methods to master when you're learning relativity. So I'm going to show you the two most famous consequences of Lorentz transformations, which is time dilation, that different observers see clocks running at the same clock running at different rates. Lorentz contraction, which means that different observers will see the same ruler to have a different length, okay, and I'm going to try and do it each of these in three different ways. So first of all, we'll do algebra. Let's consider a clock. So a clock, you know, what is a clock? Well, a clock is something which ticks. Okay, so it sits, let's say, at x equals 0. And once in a while, it ticks. Okay, so every so often in time, it gives a regular tick. And we want to know, what does that clock look like for somebody who uses a different set of coordinates, the ones natural to him or her, okay? Well, obviously, this person using the prime coordinates is going to say the value of x prime for the clock is going to be decreasing, right? Because the constant x prime lines are parallel to this axis. And so the clock is moving to more and more negative x prime. So that's obvious. If I move away from the clock, it's moving to more and more negative x prime in my coordinates. But what I want to know is what period would I infer for the clock? Would I say that clock ticks every second, or would I say a different number? And it turns out it's a different number. OK, so how do we do the calculation? We want to know, well, let's say, what period does O prime, let's say O prime uses these, an observer O prime uses these axes, and O uses those. What period does O prime infer for the clock, which has period T in the O axis, in O's axis. Okay, so this clock ticks every time T. The gap on this axis would be CT. And so now let's just do the algebra. We consider the ticks. So the ticks in CT and X, the first tick is at 0, 0, and the second tick is at CT, 0. Okay, so this an event like the tick of a clock is an event in space-time. It's a point in space-time. And these ticks are such points. Right? Every tick is a point in space-time. So here are the two adjacent ticks. And now from our Lorentz transformation, we can work out their coordinates in the O prime axis. Well, 0, 0 is still going to be at 0, 0. But this one isn't. So here I'll use those formulae down there for t prime and x prime. And here I'll get gamma ct and then minus gamma vt. So what does that mean? It means that in the O prime coordinates, the clock is not at x prime equals 0. It's at some negative x. That's reasonable. But it's at negative x given by minus v times t prime, where t prime is the period, because the clock's moving, and the distance it's moved is just the period times its velocity. And that's good, because in this coordinate, we just have ct prime, where t prime is equal to gamma t. Okay, so that is called time dilation. And it means that if an observer is moving relative to the clock, they will say that the ticks between the clock are, the time between the ticks of the clock is longer, okay, than an observer who's at rest. It's a good thing. It means that if you're moving, time goes slowly. All right, so if you want to live a long time, you need to move as fast as possible. Okay, do a lot of traveling. And this effect is very dramatic. For example, atmospheric muons have gamma, which is 1 over root 1 minus v squared over c squared, approximately 5. Yeah, they're moving very close to the speed of light. And they live about 5 times longer than they would have if they were at rest. And for this reason, they make it down to the ground level. If it was not for this effect, we wouldn't see them on the surface of the Earth. What about a ruler? So that's a clock. Let's do a ruler. So ruler is an object in space-time which occupies some length, okay, a length L. But it occupies it for all time, right? So a ruler should sit there, and the two ends of the ruler follow world lines, lines in space-time, and this is the ruler in a space-time picture. It's really a sheet. So somebody would say that any fixed time, my ruler has length 1 meter. So again, let's study the length. So what is the length of the ruler according to O prime? Okay, so, well, obviously, O prime has these coordinates, x prime and ct prime, and they're going to see the ruler moving backwards, okay, just because they're moving relative to O. But we want to know what length do they see. Now, what that means is you've got to figure out, according to, you see, O prime is going to define the ruler to be this guy. Because O prime is going to say, my ruler has a certain length at a fixed time. At a certain time, this is the length of the ruler. So it's a completely different object in space-time that O prime is talking about. And there's no reason why the length should be the same. So let's work out the coordinates of the two ends of the ruler. So the left end of the ruler is located at x equals 0. But this means that, let's call that 1. Okay, so end 1 and end 2. So x1 will be 0, so x1 prime in the primed coordinate system is given by here. So it's going backwards, just like the clock. Makes sense. X1 prime is minus gamma vt. Okay, but notice that time is the time in the original coordinate system, okay, not the time that this guy would actually use. And of course, the time the time corresponding to the left end of the ruler is just ct in the original coordinates. Ct, so time is ct. And this time, according to the new guy, the moving guy, is gamma t. Okay, so so we see, not surprisingly, that the ruler is moving, that end of the ruler is moving backwards with velocity v, according to the primed observer. No surprises there, the ruler's moving backwards because the observer's moving forwards. Okay, what about the other end of the ruler? The other end, the right end, well, that has x1 equals L and time ct. And so x2 prime is gamma L minus VT, and T2 prime is equal to gamma T minus VL over C squared, just using those formulae, substituting for X, X2 equals L, I'm sorry. It's the second, the other end of the ruler. But let us, for example, set T2 prime equals 0 to ask what's the length of the ruler along this. So let's call that L prime. So when 2T2 prime equals 0, that means that T equals VL over C squared. And then from here, from this equation, we have x2 prime equals gamma L minus V squared over C squared L, which is equal to gamma times 1 minus V squared over C squared times L, which is L over gamma, because gamma is 1 over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. And that's a Lorentz contraction because gamma is bigger than 1. Okay, so different observers see different times between ticks and of a clock, of the same clock, and they also see different lengths for the same ruler. Now, what about, so I said we could see this from the geometry. Let me draw a picture to indicate that. I'm running out of chalk here. So I will. So, oh, that's great. Thank you. Geometry. Can we see this from the geometry? Let's first do the clock. So here's CT. This length was CT. And now I need to go to the CT prime axis. X prime, this is x. So I want to know what is the period of the clock inferred by this observer, okay? And according to this observer, the time of the tick is gotten by this distance, you see, according to this observer, surfaces of lines of constant time are parallel to the x prime axis. So I must draw this line parallel to the x prime axis, which goes through the tick. Okay, and then this time is what I would call CT prime. So this moving observer sees the clock ticking at a time t prime given by this length here. Now, it looks longer, right? But that's not right. Okay, you can't just look at this and see the geometry, because the geometry we're talking about is the geometry of Minkowski space. It has a minus sign in it. So when you deal with that geometry, it's very important to calibrate your axes. You see here, this axis might be in light seconds, right? But I need to calibrate this axis. And the way I calibrate it is by using the fact, using the space-time distance. I don't use the distance in space, because that's not invariant under Lorentz transfer. I need to use the space-time distance. So CT squared minus x squared is equal to CT prime squared minus x prime squared, okay? And that means that the distance along the distance along hyperbole will be identical. Okay, as in the space-time diagram I drew. Okay, everybody will agree on the distance of points on that hyperboloid. So here we take a hyperboloid and we draw it through this point and it bends upwards. This would be the 45-degree line, so that hyperboloid is going to asymptotically approach the 45-degree line. And so what it means is that this distance here, right, is CT. And the fact that this line intercepts at a distance greater than that curve, that's time dilation. OK, Okay, a straight line intersects this axis beyond the intercept with the hyperboloid. Okay, so that's why. Now, likewise, you see, there are many paradoxes in this. If the clock is going slower, according to me, let's imagine two observers, right? One sitting there with his clock, and I walk away. Well, I say, now his clock is going more slowly I say the ticks between the time between the ticks of his clock are longer than he thinks, or longer than according to him. He may say the time ticks are every 1 second. I'll say, no, it's 2 seconds. But on the other hand, I'm moving relative to him. So he's going to say, no, the ticks on my clock are longer than his. Okay? This seems like a deep conflict. Okay? But you can see from the geometry that there really is no conflict at all, because imagine that... this is something that... You see, likewise, if my clock, the moving guy's clock, if it ticked at this interval, right, I could ask, what is the interval seen by this guy? Well, the interval is that he draws a straight line like that, because he says the interval between the ticks are given by lines parallel to the x-axis. Well, that's bigger than mine. So according to me, his clock's running slower than mine. According to him, my clock's running slower than his. So we agree about that, and we just totally disagree about what the time is. We can do the same thing with Lorentz contraction. If we have a ruler, you just draw the picture. So here's my ruler of length L. And here's my x prime axis. And then to calibrate the x prime axis, I need to draw these hyperboloids. Okay. The hyperboloid will intercept the axis here. And so that is the point L according to the moving observer, right? The moving observer will say anything which goes through this point is, let me draw a little bit clearer, so some curvature in that hyperboloid. Okay, well, the moving observer will say, no, that's a length L on my x-axis. But the end of the ruler, of course, is going straight up. So the end of the ruler is going to intercept here, which is shorter than there. And that's why you get Lorentz contraction. Okay? So geometrically, you can turn this around. You can say, okay, well, according to, if my ruler has length L, if the moving guy's ruler has length L, how long will the stationary guy say the ruler is? Let's try and do that in real time. The moving guy's ruler has length L. I'm blanking. I'll leave that to you. Okay. It can be done. Okay, I think because we're running out of time, I'm going to skip the physical experiments. Now, let's see. We probably... what's your next lecture? When is it? 10:30. Okay, so we have to stop. All right, too bad, because I was going to do some other stuff. That is a pity.
Well, we shall do the Einstein derivation in the tutorial, so that's fine.
Okay. Oh, the experiment?
Yeah.
with E equals MC squared?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, okay. It is, that's one way of doing it. So, all right, just to summarize, we've seen all these transformations, and then tutorial, you'll do E equals MC squared. It's a little bit of a pity because I have another way of deriving E equals MC squared, which, so, but in some way, but you can read about this in part in Z's book. And I just encourage you to do that. Can I take 5 minutes and explain it to you? It is the most famous equation in physics, right? So it's fun to see where it comes from.
Well, actually, in the tutorial, I follow Z. So
oh, really?
They will see it.
From the action, the relativistic particle action?
Oh,
no. Okay, let me, yeah, there are many things in Z's book. Okay, let me try and do this quickly. So E equals MC squared. Where the hell does this come from? The quick derivation is as follows, okay, and actually can be justified formally in a very nice way, which I may tell you later in the course. But let's take a particle whose action is a half x dot squared, right? When you do Newtonian mechanics, just a free particle has a kinetic energy. And often we add to it the potential energy, right? But for the moment, don't worry too much about the potential. Let's just focus on the kinetic. Now, as soon as you write that down, you've got a horrible clash with relativity, okay? This is not Lorentz invariant in the slightest, right? There's no mu index to be seen. If you do a Lorentz transformation, everything will change. This is a total disaster, okay? So you can say, how could I possibly write down a Lorentz invariant action for a particle? Okay, so what would you try to do? Well, one Lorentz invariant, which I've mentioned already, is this dt squared minus, c squared dt squared minus dx squared. Okay, that's a Lorentz invariant quantity. So I could divide this, well, yeah, so that's Lorentz invariant. In fact, what it's called is the proper time, c squared. Okay, so this is Lorentz invariant. So how do we make an action out of this quantity? Okay. So notice that I can write it as follows. You see, what I want to do is go from this to that, to this term. Take the square root, cdt equals the square root, and pull out the cdt. Okay, so now it is 1 minus 1 over c squared dx dt squared. See, this is d tau. So that's a Lorentz invariant quantity. 1 minus v squared over c squared. Okay? We can get rid of the c's. So how close is this to that? Well, not very, but at least it involves the velocity squared. All right? And now imagine the velocity is small. So then we say this is 1, approximately 1, minus 1 half x dot squared over c squared. Right? So I'm getting closer to this. Well, let me multiply it by mc squared, okay? And let me put a minus sign, okay? So then I can say my s relativistic will be this, okay, I'm going to multiply by minus mc squared, okay? So this quantity together will give me minus mc squared from the 1 plus 1 half m x dot squared. Okay? So if I take this quantity, which is Lorentz invariant, and multiply it by mc squared, I get the right kinetic term for the particle. So what I need to do is write a relativistic action, which is the following, minus mc squared integral dt root 1 minus dx dt over c squared. And that is approximately equal to integral dt 1 half m x dot squared minus m c squared. Sorry? Oh, thanks. Okay. So the relativistic action, which reproduces this term, automatically brings in a potential energy, which is mc squared. Well, that's the potential energy of the particle. Okay, so the PE of the particle, because action is kinetic minus potential, potential energy of particle equals mc squared. Okay, so that's it. So Lorentz invariance is a very powerful thing. And in fact, this I wish I had more time, because this derivation actually is formally absolutely correct. Okay, that when you write the action down, the action is the origin of conservation laws. When you try to explain why is momentum conserved, why is energy conserved, they all come directly from the action. And all that formalism respects Lorentz invariance. And basically, this one can show completely formally that the energy is the potential energy of the particle is mc squared. And so this derivation is, in fact, you know, absolutely correct. When you introduce interactions and so on, this is the right way to think about it. There's a way of deriving E equals mc squared using a thought experiment, which is what Einstein did. And you know, that confirms this picture, and you'll do that this afternoon.